All right, so tonight we begin a new book of the Torah, the book of Shemot. And of course, the Parsha has the very same name, Parsha Shemot. And it deals, of course, the Jews are now in Egypt, and the Parsha deals with the Jews being sliding into slavery. And then, of course, the birth of Moshe, the episode of Moshe, him fleeing, the Jews continuing to suffer, and then the calling of Moshe into to be the redeemer, and comes back to Zohar, and then comes back like 55 years later. And then the Parsha ends with Moshe failing initially in his mission. That's the entire Parsha. We're going to take a particular slender aspect of the Parsha. But before we do, we're going to do a little video, as I like to do. Get that locked and loaded here. Right. Now we'll see. And I will share that with you. Okay. All right. So if you're on the phone, you will. It says this is in German or Polish, whatever. So you will need to read the, unless you know Polish or this Slavic language. German, I think. But basically, I'm going to set up the. This is from a clip from a movie where partisans. Let's see, what are partisans?
Partisans are people who fought back against various groups.
Right. Partisans were either Jews or non-Jews that hid. Were organized into clandestine militias who were doing World War II, at least, would go out and like hide in the forest and then attack in a guerrilla style way the German army. Okay? Those are the partisans. Some partisans were also anti-Semitic. They hated the Nazis, but they also hated the Jews. So tragically, sometimes Jews would join the partisans and they would get killed. Because the partisans themselves were anti-Semitic. It's like sort of like a horrible situation. But here, we're going to go to a video, and the partisans about to do an attack on a train which is bound for a concentration camp. Okay, so let's do a little share screen. Okay, here we go.
Od kiedy Niemiec wie, co to jest dobry bigos?
Brzmi jak dobry gulasz.
Gulasz?
Gulasz.
Bigos to żaden gulasz.
Bigos to Polska.
Mówiłeś, że pociąg będzie o 9:00.
Tak i co? Ja jestem odpowiedzialny za Niemców? Może już skapitulowali?
Ignoruje znak stopu i pojedzie dalej?
Tego nie zrobi.
Ein deutscher Beamter ignoriert kein deutsches Schild.
Myślę, że załatwiliśmy wszystkich.
Myślę, że tak. Pierwsza grupa za mną. Skąd się wziął, że diabła?
Jeden jeszcze został!
Mamy go? Naprzód.
Okay. All right. So, as you saw in the Partisan movie, that basically they were able to get the Germans and so here's the question. Question number one. Good. And then the next phase of the movie is they go and they release all the Jews that were you know, on their way to a concentration camp, as well as they obviously have to pillage all the munitions from the Germans.
So they knew what was on that train? Who was on that train?
Well, in other words, what they did was they put a stop sign, a German stop sign, you know, and their goal was to stop, you know, have the guy stop. They would shoot all the people, shoot all the German army, the driver, and then be able to release the prisoners, gain the supplies and the munitions. Okay, that was a basic part of the. But it's just an opportunity for me to ask basically two questions. One, what is the Partisan's justification to kill all these people?
It's war. They're fighting for their country, for their people.
Okay, it's war. What else?
They're stopping the inevitable death of hundreds of other people.
Right, so first of all, it's a just war. So therefore, fighting the Nazis intrinsically is a just war. And two, they have a second thing. There's a second factor. They are preventing the inevitable murder of all these Jews and all these prisoners.
It's all utilitarian justification. I mean, you have Kantian ethics and utilitarian ethics. Whether, you know, you go for the greater good versus each human life is intrinsically valuable and you cannot trade off one for the other.
So how would you respond to Adrian? Is it just because one life is better than the other,
or there's more more lives on one side than the other? All lives are equal according to quantum ethics.
Is it simply a mathematical calculation here? And which gets into the question number two. Which Adrian's question really gets into the role of the question number two. Is there a halachic justification for the Partisans' war on the Nazis?
Well, yeah, one is the aggressor, one is not.
So is it only because of the aggressors?
Well, they're killing them. In the case of Germans rounding up and murdering Jews specifically, it's because they're murdering Jews specifically.
Well, let's say it was a transport train. And it just had German soldiers. And let's say they had the opportunity to stop the train and then just basically shoot the entire train and kill 500 German soldiers. Would that be justified?
I'm not sure.
I think, yeah.
Why, Ruthie?
Because, okay, like at that moment in World War II, those Nazi soldiers were all like in operation of killing innocent people. Like that was their mission. That's what they're in the middle of doing. So aren't they like really classified as like road aides, all of them? That's what they're in the middle of doing. Even if they're being transported from one place of killing lots of people, not just Jews, but also Jews, to another place of killing lots of people, like, don't people like partisans who have the ability to stop them, don't they have like a halachic basis, even an obligation to try to do that?
Okay, so
if they were just like German people walking in the park, even in Nazi times, like walking in the park with their families, maybe not, but they're like Nazi soldiers in uniform on like a military transport train going to do a mission.
Okay, right?
I don't know if everybody got that point. Ruthie brought up a concept called road ape. I'm not sure if everybody knows that. Road ape means the pursuer. The halakha is as follows. If somebody is going to kill somebody else, they at that point lose you. You could do anything you can to stop them. Ideally, you should try to shoot them in the leg. But if you kill them, you're not obligated. Is that the justification? Are they defined as a rodeif, or is it more primary than that?
Also, it kind of reminds me of our commandment to wipe out Amalek.
Okay, there's another. So the major question in the, what's called the law or rule of war, is question number one: is the war justified? Okay, so if you say the war against, if you come to the conclusion that the war against the Nazis is justified, then to do anything to stop them, to kill them, is completely justified. You know, in other words, you don't have to, in other words, they become defined as what's called the enemy, and therefore you can kill every single one of them. Not a problem. It's not Rodave is a much more it's more in a civilian circumstance where somebody for whatever reason is trying to kill somebody else, so you have ability to stop them. You can't just kill them, but you have to stop them initially if they shoot them in the leg, let's say. But if you would kill them, you would not be responsible for a death penalty. There is another dimension going on here as well, that also outside the phenomena of war, if somebody comes to kill you, you get them first, okay? In other words, the basic principle of self-defense. These people are coming to kill. They're on a mission to wipe out the partisans, to wipe out Jews. You know, you kill them first. That's separate from the war. But once you define it's a just war, and as you said, like in Judaism, have different kinds of war, then you have a right to annihilate them. Not only annihilate, you have an obligation to annihilate them. Okay, until they surrender. Okay. So I'm just bringing this. Okay, it's not an issue of one life versus another. Once they become defined as the enemy, their right of life has basically been taken from them, and therefore the job is to do everything you can to stop them until they surrender and accept a unconditional surrender. Which, by the way, you know, the Germans and the Japanese both did at the end of World War II. Okay. So that's the base. It's more complicated than this. So basically, once it gets defined as a war, as a justified war, that's it. In a civilian circumstance, you have two factors to deal with. Either a rodeif, which Ruthie brought up, or B, a balaharka, one who comes to kill you, you kill him first. The law of self-defense, okay? I'm bringing this up because it's very relevant. Because we get introduced to the beginning of Moshe's active life. Let's jump into the parsha.
Yeah, but before we start, can the whoever's typing mute themselves, please?
Sorry.
Okay. All right. Let's have. All right. Somebody want to read Moshe, the beginning of the Moshe story here. 2:11. All right, Shane, read.
When Moses was grown, he began to go out to his own people, and he saw their hard labor. One day, he saw an Egyptian harshly beating one of his fellow Hebrews. Moshe looked all around, and when he saw that no one was watching, he killed the Egyptian and hid his body in the sand. Moshe went the next day, and he saw two Hebrew men fighting. Why are you beating your brother? He demanded of the one who was in the wrong. Who made you our prince and judge? Retorted the other. Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Moshe was frightened. The incident is known, he said.
Okay, so this is scene one. So as you know, this is a story that you guys should be very familiar with, that Moshe, of course, was adopted by the princes of Egypt. She raised him. And at some point, I guess the Torah does not give us an age. Let's figure 18, 20, 25, and that around that age. He goes out to see his own people. So he knew, first of all, so you see from that, he knew, he was informed that he, in fact, is Jewish. It could be that his parents visited him, were allowed to visit him during his early childhood. B, he sensed he's different, and his Paro and the family told him that he's a Jewish. He's from a Jewish family. You may have told him that. Okay. We've had class in the past on Parsha Shmos, which you can go on to Wai Torah, dealing with a very interesting question. It's like, why did the person who grew up in a non-Jewish home, educated by non-Jewish people, ultimately become the Adon HaNaviim, not just a prophet, but the master of all prophets? So the most unlikely circumstance, the most assimilated environment, was our greatest Jew. So we discussed that in a different class. You can check out that class on Yahu Torah. We're not dealing with that today. So then he sees the Egyptian, you know, beating up a fellow Hebrew. He looks all around. He sees that no one's watching. He kills him and hides the body. Okay. Next day, he sees two Jews fighting, and then he says, "Why are you beating your brother?" And then, of course, now, ironically, and this we discussed actually recently in the senior fellowship, who made you our prince and judge? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? First of all, how do they know this? This is like the next day.
The person who was saved probably spoke about it.
Exactly. So the Jew who was saved, which is shocking, understanding what a high risk gesture that Moshe had done, just start blabbing the story to everybody. But any regard for the safety and well-being of Moshe, who was living as a prince of Egypt and extended himself in a very vulnerable way. And what did he get in return? Ratted out.
He thought of Moshe as part of the system, as part of the ruling class. So he probably had he didn't have that much regard for him in that sense.
Yeah. No, but Adrian, he is, in other words, if he views him as an Egyptian, then he should be afraid of him because he's part of the ruling class. Here, he's now, Moshe is taking the position of being a savior to the Jews. And what kind of response is he getting? He's getting a very dismissive response. What are you going to do? You going to kill me? Who made you our prince and judge? In other words, they rejected him. Hmm. They didn't want his help. He's a guy from the inside helping him out. This is a good example of the phrase, no good deed goes unpunished. This is the best. He risks his neck. And what does he get? He gets dismissed. What happens? Pasuk 15. Let's take it from there. Suzanne Bavakasha.
When Pharaoh heard about the affair, he took steps to have Moshe put to death. Moshe fled from Pharaoh and ended up in the land of Midian. Moshe was sitting...
Okay, stop right there. So first of all, why did Paro want to kill Moshe? Based upon the plain text.
He killed the Egyptian.
So you're saying because, yeah, but do you think that if you're part of the ruling class, you have the rules apply to you?
I saw him as a threat.
Why is he a threat?
Because, first of all, he's Jewish, and he saw someone Jewish getting beat up, and that's why he killed the Egyptian. So Pharaoh figured that, Moses would do exactly what he did do, save the Jews.
Okay.
I think this whole incident is weird.
One second.
Because, like, why did they say to him, who made you our prince and judge? What do you mean? Moshe was a prince of Egypt. He is their prince. The answer is yes. He's their prince and a little bit their judge. Yes. And I think it's weird that Paro commanded that he be killed. Like, that's weird. Why did Paro protect him?
Right, so you're saying it's weird. Rightfully so.
I think it's because I would suspect that it has something to do with Pharaoh's understanding that if Moses becomes more in touch with his cultural roots and wants to stand up and actually become their actual leader and their actual prince, then he could have a serious situation in the form of a revolt or revolution on his hands.
I mean, isn't that jumping the gun in the story a little bit? We know that because we know the end. But did Paro know that?
I actually do not. I did not know the end necessarily, and I was assuming that from the text.
Right. The end is that Moses leads the Jews out of Egypt. That's the end.
Yes, obviously we all know that. Okay.
No, come on.
Okay, so first of all, just to put it all together, is that Sean suggested, do you guys hear me clearly? Yeah, I just changed, of course, my my Bluetooth headset ran out of juice. Good timing. All right. bear with me for 1 second here. All right.
I'll expand my answer and say
Dad,
that he killed the Egyptian and showed that he was disloyal to the Egyptians and that he was more loyal to the Hebrews.
Right. So now you're no. That's not modifying. That's changing your answer. That's all changing your answer. In other words, before you're saying is that he did a capital offense. So if you kill somebody, you should get killed. Now you're saying Paro doesn't care about an individual Egyptian, but he recognized that basically he realized that he had basically nurtured the greatest threat to his own power. He wants to control this slave nation, and essentially he has raised the Redeemer. Because by killing the Egyptian, where does Moshe show where his loyalty is?
The Jews.
Right. Or basically, the Torah does not record it, but obviously when the daughter of Paro brought home this Jewish baby, there was a conversation that had, like, what are you doing? Because that was during the edict, just a couple of verses earlier, where all Jewish baby boys had to be thrown into the Nile. So not only is this baby not being thrown in the Nile, she's adopting the child, and she's raising it as his own. So obviously, what does she have to justify it? I love him. He's very cute. And they basically argue would be, by raising him as an Egyptian, he would be a full Egyptian citizen. He would identify with the, being a prince and ultimately part of the ruling class. He'd like to... In other words, Moshe's life, what was Moshe's life like in the early years?
Good. He was
just
a prince
good.
Of Egypt.
Just
I mean,
good.
Great.
In other words, he was living the life of absolute luxury as a top aristocrat in the most powerful nations of the world.
Yeah, he was very indoctrinated.
So they could imagine that, yeah, he'd rather, of course, he might know he's Jewish, but why would he want to identify with the slaves when he's living on the equivalent of Fifth Avenue in a penthouse with servants, you know, with every imaginable luxury? Of course, he's going to want to maintain and identify with the Egyptians. But the fact that once Paro saw that he had killed the Egyptian, he does not view himself as an Egyptian anymore. Moshe is a Jew. And now all that education is now going to be turned against the Egyptian state. Therefore, what? He has to be killed. To put it very simply, Paro realized he is an enemy of the state and needs to be killed, even though he raised him as his own grandson. You have a grandfather coldly putting all the security forces, the army, the police, the Secret Service, whatever they had in those days, to get one thing: kill Moshe. Moshe then, the Torah doesn't tell you, he ended up in the land of Midian. Now, clearly in this story, when he kills the Egyptian, he's around 25 years old. We know he shows up in Egypt. The Torah says openly he's 80 years old. So that's a 55-year gap. So I believe it's the Ibn Ezra that points out that basically Moshe was on the run from the authorities, living as a fugitive for over 50 years. And the episode we're going to get to now of being in Midian was the last of his destination. You know what I'm saying? So that activity to save that one Jew basically cost, he gave up his entire, you know, young life. He gave up his young adulthood for the Jewish people. What did he get in response? Nothing but pain.
It seems that it was almost an impulsive action that he took. I mean, I don't know if he premeditated, you know, and like made this decision as thoughtfully as you sort of put it. It's more like in the moment type of situation.
Well, so we're gonna delve right into that. But we have one more episode to read. So let's have Suzanne read the next episode. Keep on going. He shows up at Midian, and then of course Moshe is sitting near the well. Let's go.
The Sheikh of Midian had seven daughters who came to draw water. As they were beginning to fill the trough and water their father's sheep, other shepherds came and tried to chase them away. Moshe got up and came to their aid and then watered their sheep.
Okay. All right. So I want to see again. Now, these episodes, if we take the Ibn Ezra's understanding, happened at the beginning at age 25 and the other maybe at 75 or 70. You know, we don't know exactly how long he was in Midian. Okay. But he stands up for these women are getting pushed around and being whatever. And he stands up and he protects them and then he waters their sheep. Okay, so let's go to a couple questions, which of course Adrian started us off. So question number one, what justification does Moshe have to kill the Mitzri? Let's start with that.
Roy?
What?
Rodef or Roy or whatever it's called.
So you're arguing that the Egyptian is pursuing to kill this Jew, and therefore Moshe has no choice other than to kill him.
Right.
Okay. What else do we get? Give me some more possible. There's not one possible. What else we got?
It's the right thing to do.
I'm asking, why is the right thing to do?
Because you see someone who can't defend themselves, and then you have like the other person who's got like a weapon and is, you know, mercilessly, you know, beating them. It's your duty as like, you know.
Well, does he know that necessarily he's going to kill him?
I don't think he did. Maybe it just got out of hand.
Well, so for example, the Rode point seems that the guy is pursuing to kill him. Let's say he's just beating him up because he's an Egyptian taskmaster, and that's what they do. they beat the slaves. Everybody saw 12 years a slave, right? That's what, or you saw, if you saw a long time ago, you saw Roots. So any slaves, any time a situation where you see taskmasters or plantation owners beating slaves, they generally did not kill them because that's actually their property, and you're going to now lose a vital worker. They're just trying to teach them a lesson, but they might beat them, mercilessly. So if there's no definitely going to kill him, we don't know. So if you argue he's going to kill him, so therefore the Rode principle would apply. Let's say he's not going to kill him. I mean, because otherwise, is Moshe just basically a murderer? Let me take the other tack. Is Moshe, our Redeemer, a vigilante, cold-blooded murderer? What do you say?
Would Moshe, have to have killed him if he, stopped him from beating him?
I'm asking you guys.
Well, if he stopped him from beating this slave, he kind of, he outed himself as, a sympathizer to other Jews. Bring him up.
In other words, you're saying that he did not have, if he would just, let's say, knock him down, injure him so the Jew can run away, then he would be identified as being a savior of the Jews, and therefore get himself in the same danger he's trying to avoid, which he ended up with anyway, because the Jews himself outed. He would have been outed, and then he would have become. Right. Pharaoh would have had the same thing. He would have run and tried to kill him. So basically, his only choice was either do nothing, or kill the Egyptian. But the question I'm asking again is, what justification in our the Torah says, "Lo tirzach, thou shalt not murder." Definition of murder: unjustified killing. My question to you all, what's the justification?
But is it relevant that, isn't there more to the story about this guy that was, Moshe knew that he was a really bad guy.
Well, he's an Egyptian taskmaster. That's pretty bad as its own right.
Right.
But I understand what Suzanne's trying to say. This guy's really sadistic, over the other taskmasters.
He's super bad. Okay. Right. And so what justification?
So my question is, what are the legal parameters of self-defense? If you have a person and he's going to torture someone, and your only chance to stop him is to kill him, would you be justified in killing someone who's going to torture an innocent person? I don't know what the halacha is.
Right. So that's an interesting question. My question is, you're not just, because obviously Moshe could have just walked on by because he's part of the regime. But he stopped. He intervened. So it's not an issue of self-defense. He's just defending a poor victim here. And the question we're asking is, what is the justification?
Still self-defense.
Still
self-defense. In other words, he's functioning as his emissary, agent.
Isn't it a sin to see something like this happen to your brother and keep walking? Doesn't that make you, as part of the crime, almost as the one who's physically doing it?
Not in the U.S. You don't have a duty to help in the U.S.
Well, but in the Torah?
I think it's really telling that the scripture says Moshe was frightened. The incident is known.
Well, he's frightened not because... He's not frightened about that he killed the Egyptian. He's frightened about now becoming outed and becoming an enemy of the state. And he knew, once it's discovered, he knew that Paro was going to try to kill him. That's why he ran. He just checked out. He fled. So here's the deal. The question really is, there's a couple of approaches here. One approach is the question is, what is the nature of the Egyptian regime? Once the Egyptian regime has unjustly incarcerated and oppressed and pressed into slavery and tortured and did acts of genocide against the Jewish people, does that not make the Egyptians enemies? And therefore, you don't need to get to the individual, factor of, about a self-defense principle or a Rode principle. You have, they are the enemies of, if the Egyptians are not the enemies of the Jews, well, who are the enemies of Jews? They've been oppressing them for over 100 years. Right?
Don't you need an organized body? Halakhically, don't you need an organized body in order to be able to declare that all certain people are enemies and then have a...
No. You have to have, in other words, in halakha, there's two kinds of war. There's milchemet mitzvah. There's an obligatory war that the Jewish people as a nation must obligate to fight. Such as Amalek, the seven nations, but they're also if any nation comes to fight the Jews, they're automatically the milchemes mitzvah. A milchemes rishus, a non-obligatory war that has to be done in concert with the king and the Sanhedrin and a navi. Right, requires all three branches. So here, now, and once there's enemies, people who are actively creating a program of oppression and of murder, that's it. Anybody part of that regime is open season. Open season. So from a halachic standpoint, now again, this is also before the Torah. In a certain sense, halacha is not really operational. You know what I'm saying? Now you notice that's, but now we have, okay, we're going to get to this. So that's, I think the first response is that the Egyptian Empire and its workers, like the Nazis, all enemies, and are able if it's appropriate, such as not going to get killed yourself, you kill them to stop their treachery. Okay, we go on. Question number four. The Torah does not share much biographical information of Moshe's early years. Why are these incidents critical to introducing the character of the prophet of Hashem? In other words, these are Moshe's early years. What do you see? First case, he kills a dude. And the second one is that a bunch of aggressive shepherds are harassing these seven women, who, by the way, are daughters of a Midian idolatrous priest. They Rabbi Kaplan changed it from to a sheik, but okay. But the plain text is that he's a Kohen Midian. Kohen Midian means he's a. So these are, he's not saving Jews, he's not protecting Jews, he's protecting non-Jews, right? These are women who grew up to by Yitro, who at this point is a idolater. Right, so it's not a Jew thing. He sees them being oppressed, being beaten up, being harassed, and he intervenes. So the question is, why is that critical? How does that come to inform the early elements of the person who will ultimately become a prophet, and not just a prophet, but the prophet? Yeah, Donah Naviim, the master of all prophets. Two incidents. What do we see? What do we learn from this?
I think that we learn that a prophet has to have empathy and recognize, like, his connection to Hashem, because even before Moshe, before he had, like, prophecies, just by defending and killing this, like, evil taskmaster, he showed empathy and he showed his ability to go above and beyond for Israel.
Well, but the second case was not for a Jewish people. It wasn't an empathy or identification. It wasn't only about identifying with his brother. That was case one. And is it only empathy? Sure, there's empathy, but what quality or what qualities is really determinative here?
Well, he's willing to do whatever it takes to, so like he essentially he turns against everything that he knows, right? Like we would think that he would, since he was raised in the house of Paro, that he would be loyal to Paro and that he wouldn't be loyal to, you know, the Jewish people that weren't the Jewish people yet. But you know what I'm saying? Like he has this connection.
Okay. What else can we say? Anybody else want to add to that? What qualities did Moshe have, clearly, from these incidents?
Empathy?
Well, that's what Amanda said. Oh. Empathy, identified with the pain of others, and did whatever he could. But what other qualities are there?
Leadership?
What aspect of leadership? There's nobody else there. He's not leading anybody there. It's just him.
Nobody told him what to do. He just did it because he knew it was the right thing to do.
Okay, so he's clearly very self-directed and very clear in his principles. So first of all, he's very courageous. He's courageous, and he's what they call a gibor. He's mighty. In other words, the fact that there, in other words, how many, is he the only guy, is there only one other shepherd harassing these women? He's taken on a gang of shepherds, okay? In other words, he's a bystander. He's just a traveler. Let's get the scene down. He's at the well, chilling, and he's watching the scene. These seven women come with their flock of sheep. The other bunch of men start messing with these women to basically take their water. In other words, they did the hard work of getting the water out of the well, filling the trough to give their sheep water. What they did, they're going to shoo them away, and they're going to use their water. Basically, they're being jerks. They're basically stealing from them. It's like a kind of a mugging. And he's taking on all these people. He's not afraid. So first of all, he has no fear. He's committed to doing what he thinks is the right thing. It's unjust that women come minding their own business to give water for their sheep, and then these guys come and abuse them. In other words, ironically, Moshe is the first Me Too hero over here. He's stepping in when nobody's doing anything. He steps up to the plate. And it's not his fight. Most people would keep on walking. In other words, you say, like, I'm one guy, and those are five or eight shepherds. I'm not going to, you know, 5 or 8 to 1 is not a good number. He didn't care. He goes in there. He gives them a little attitude change by taking their face to the pavement. Okay? So Moshe, by the way, this is our hero, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rabban HaNaviim. He is our lawgiver. His prophecy, his download of the prophecy, which is the Torah, is the centerpiece of the entire Jewish people. And his early years was A, growing up among, you know, non-Jews, 2, rescuing a Jew from a Nazi-like oppressor and killing him and burying his body, and then later, beating on some pagan shepherds to protect these women, okay? So you see a person who is clear about what is just and what is not just, A, identifies and emphasizes, Amanda says, to the plight of the victim, 3, steps up and does what it takes, and 4, has very little fear about what's going to happen to himself, you know what I'm saying? He does what it takes. He's not a wussy. Okay, so that's point number. Okay, now I didn't get a chance to translate this. I want to read with you. This is the Ralbag's comment, and then I want to actually take the class to deal with a contemporary issue, because we have a situation now in America over the last month or two where the level of anti-Semitic incidents and craziness against the Jewish community, we have not seen this in decades or maybe even ever. I don't want to go through the Ralbag has four principles that we learn from Moshe, and I'm just going to read it through you. I'm going to go right to the English. He says, the fourth principle is B'midos, to teach us good quality traits. The person should take care of his fellow Jew. And fight their fight. When they are being victimized by violence. So if the Jewish people are being victimized by violence, there's another he doesn't use the justification. That alone allows you to, you know, get locked and loaded to fight back. He goes on, hello, Tira, Ki Moshe Rabbeinu, because we see that Moshe, our teacher, Lechozik Ritzono L'Riv Riv Shel Ben Yisrael, in his energetic will to fight the fight of this Jew, and we saw the violence that the Egyptian was doing. Kamalav, he got up, v'ikau nefesh, and he killed him. V'sam nafsho b'zab b'sakana tzuma, and he put his very soul in profound danger. Ad shehufra livroach, until it meant that he had to run for his life. So that's what the quality of a Jew is. You care about your fellow Jew, and you see a Jew getting pushed around, you step up. You get involved. That's point number one. In other words, it's not just a Moshe Rabbeinu thing, it's what a good Jew should do. That's part number one. Point number two, HaTo'al Tashvi, the seventh principle of Midos. Husharoi L'Shalem, Shispael Me'achamasim K'shiyazdu L'Eza Shiyeh. It is appropriate for a perfected person to be moved when somebody's being victimized from violence, and do everything you can to stop people being victimized. That's why it teaches this story, the power of his action, of Moshe, from all the violence, the otzim hagvurato, and the power of his mightiness, al-hasaratam, of removing the violence against both the Jew and the Midianite women, the birat libo, and sort of the majesty of his soul, the greatness of his soul. With that, these qualities make him fitting to be a prophet. The Gemara says there are four qualities of a navi: chacham, givor, ashir. What's the fourth one? I think also Balcoma. All right. But the key ones I remember off, a wise but mighty, having being a courageous spirit is a quality of a Navi. And the Ralbag here in his commentary sees these stories as sort of giving a foreshadowing, a harbinger of Moshe the Navi. Right now he's not a Navi. Next, last one. Hatuel Hachi, the ninth principle. It's appropriate for a person to stir to get motivated to save the weak, and to save them from their oppressors, because they have no power to protect themselves. And that way he will perfect and improve society. And therefore, people will help each other out. The quality, by helping the victims, it helps everybody. For that very reason, we see that Moshe got involved, got motivated to save, to rescue the daughters of Yitro from the shepherds, and to give. Notice he didn't just. In other words, that's another thing. If you rescue them, why did he go ahead and do the additional step of then giving the sheep water to drink? In other words, why did he do their job for them? I never thought about it till this very moment. In other words, one thing is that he chased away the guys. So they were giving the water to, they were giving the sheep to drink. They said, all right, guys, you can go back. Why did he go ahead and give the sheep water to drink at that point?
He probably knew that women were so, you know, exasperated, scared, you know, just overwhelmed what just happened. And feeding their sheep is like the last thing they want to be doing right now or could be doing.
So exactly. In other words, they just got mugged. So they're shaken. And Moshe came in and saved them. So they're all just flustered or, you know, stressed out. So an additional chesed is that he went ahead and did their work, which is to give all the sheep, you know, water to drink. Correct. And he says, so therefore, the same reason of a basic quality of justice is that the good person protects people who get victimized by oppressors. Okay? So it's interesting that Ralbag does not utilize any of the quote-unquote halachic mechanisms. He just brings on he brings two general principles. A, the Jewish people are getting oppressed. That's it. You gotta help out. Number two, if any person, Jew or non-Jew, is being oppressed, you gotta get involved. It's in America they have the Good Samaritan law. The Good Samaritan is the character in the New Testament who helped out, and he got involved, and so therefore he's called the Good Samaritan. But we don't have a Good Samaritan. We have basically lo samad, lo tamod al dam riecha. Do not stand idly by the blood of your friend, of your neighbor. In other words, you got to get involved. You don't have this, don't get involved business. Okay? That's what the parameters of that is, a separate shear. Okay. Here we go. Now I'm bringing it 100% practical to right now. Moshe is forced to fulfill his responsibility in protecting his Jewish brethren. With the increased rise of anti-Semitism, what lesson does Moshe's example imply regarding our own obligation to protect the Jewish community? You know, it was the seventh night of Hanukkah in Muncie, New York, and this madman bust into a house of Hasidim and start mercilessly chopping people into pieces. What is our what's the Moshe ask response?
Kill him.
Well, to stop him.
Yeah, to protect people.
Stop him, to protect the lives of the other people that are there.
Right.
All right, so now, have we fulfilled our obligation to protect fellow Jews by hiring outside guards or getting police protection? Is that sufficient?
Yeah.
No.
I think not completely.
Yes, no, let's discuss. Go ahead. All right, so Shane is shaking her head.
It's not enough.
Not enough. Why not?
Because we need to protect our own. We need to be out there with them, working with those we hire to protect our own. We have more of a sense of connection to our fellow Jews, and therefore we'll probably work harder to protect them as opposed to someone we're hiring and paying to do the job for us.
Okay, so you're saying, in other words, that even if every shul in America, like our synagogue here in West Hempstead, New York, just hired right after the attack in Muncie, hired a second armed guard for the shul, okay? Now, you know, obviously there's much conversation about having people in the shul carry concealed weapons. Now, the key thing, everybody will agree with you that to have a gun is not a solution because it requires a profound amount of training, especially if there is a intruder, a live shooter. That actually, to be able to, in a situation when things are going crazy, to be able to have the training and the presence of mind to be able to take down the shooter without, you know, killing, you know, one of the kids, the bystander. It's not so simple. It's not just everybody go out and apply for a permit to have a concealed weapon is going to solve the problem. So that's one aspect. But so anybody agree? First of all, that's Shana's point. Does everybody feel that getting, you know, you guys, if you're near MJE, they have the bulletproof door. They have it with a you know, they have a automatic locking situation. Sometimes they have a guard at different hours. It's very expensive to have it, you know, 18 hours a day.
And the door is bulletproof?
The front door is a $75,000 bulletproof door. Yeah.
In the first floor or 10th floor?
No, the first floor. Oh. The entrance of the building, the only main entrance of the building is a bulletproof door.
Well, not really sure. You should hide. You shouldn't just stand behind the glass doors.
So that was there. You know, when they did a security analysis, that in addition to their guards, they invested in that, and that plus a locking mechanism. So if there is a concern, they only buzz everybody in. I'm sure you've ever been to MJE. You need to be buzzed in sometimes. You're not so careful with that. But whatever.
There's just another viewpoint. Please. There's no way that I would be able to, like, you know, beat up any or kill any, intruder, like, say, God forbid, to MJE. I mean, I would, like, maybe hide myself, my son. But so I'm not doing anything. So, yeah, I think – but if I, like, pay my dues to get a security guard, something like that, I feel like I'm definitely doing my part or my obligation.
Right. Okay. I hear that. Anybody else want to comment on that?
I think it's possible.
Shade is stronger than me.
Oh, one at a time.
No, that's okay. Go ahead, John.
Oh, yes. No, I was just making a joke. Maybe Shayna is, like, better at Krav Maga than I am. But.
She is.
So, Rabbi, may I talk about Legion?
Yeah, I'm giving you the intro over here. So let me give the introduction here. So I in other words, the question that we're dealing with here, this is an area where it's not very clear cut about exactly, because we're heading into a new situation. Has anybody here traveled to Europe and spent a Shabbat in any of the European cities and gone to a synagogue?
No, but I heard Paris it's very, like, you have to, like, call them ahead of time, send them your passport. It's like the level of security is a lot higher.
Yeah, it's not only in the city, but also, for example, I had friends who are going to Panama for yeshiva break. In order to go to shul, they have to do the following. They need to send a copy of their passport.
Right.
They have to get a letter from their rabbi that they're, in fact, Jewish. So, therefore, because they do a very... to get you into, and of course around the shul, there's a guy checking, so they have the regulars, so they probably have an easy way to check in the regulars. But if you're just a once a year visitor to Panama City in their shuls, you have to do an elaborate, you gotta get a letter from the rabbi, picture from the other thing. So it's like the shul is in lockdown, and their guys there, especially in cities in various, where there'll be officers from the army or from the police with, like, you know, semi-automatic rifles. Okay, so literally the shul is like in a lockdown situation. Okay, so this is a conversation that needs to have happened, and you see that Moshe Rabbeinu is not. There is a place, a time and a place for force. So I got an email on Sunday from none other than Shayna, who invited, I guess, everybody to talk to, and I'm going to put the thing on, one second.
Bless you.
Okay, so everybody can see Shayna's email to me? Great, hold on one second. Let me just, bear with me. I'll share. Okay, give me a second here. Okay. All right, we're going to do a little share screen action. Okay, this is what, is everybody clear now? Can everybody see it now? All right, so Shayna sent me this invitation for the Legion Jewish Defense Training Program. And there's supposed to be a conference call this coming Friday. So Shayna, without further ado, take it away.
Legion is an organization that was started about 5 years ago in response to the growing number of anti-Semitic attacks globally and locally. And their whole mission is no one's going to protect, or they're of the understanding that no one's going to protect us except for ourselves. And so what can we do to teach the Jewish people self-defense? And they partner with Krav Maga gyms, MMA gyms, depending on the location, to teach regular people how to defend ourselves. What's nice about Legion, it's a 9-month commitment where we have to go at least twice a week, but we have 4 classroom sessions. And to Rabbi Pinney's point about if you have an armed guard situation, one of our trainings is actually just that, where it's an active shooter training, where some people come in with guns, with blanks, and will shoot, so we know how to react and what to do when we hear those sounds and what's going on. And then our last classroom session is on emergency medicine. God forbid there is an active shooter and someone gets shot, how to apply a tourniquet and all that stuff. So they're currently in 6 locations locally. But in response, or not actually in response, but in reaction to everything that's been going on between Munsey and everything else that we're hearing, they've been getting a whole lot of phone calls about, we want Legion in our city. We want Legion here. We want Legion there. They used to be very much under the radar. It was word of mouth only. They have since hired a PR company to start helping them spread their word and get positive press. And so the call on Friday is for locations that don't currently have a chapter, how to start their own chapter. And then for the communities where there is a chapter already, they're starting something called Legion Reserves, where you can get the discounted training that we get. And you can then you still have to go through the whole application and background check to get into the proper class, but it at least gives you a beginning and gives you a discounted rate to make it more, approachable or reachable for everybody.
But if I understand correctly, is that the basic point is that, you know, in Brooklyn, among the Hasidic community, there have been a lot of people have been just beaten up. But if there was a movement where Jews, as a regularity, not every single one, but a regularity, learn self-defense, that you don't know if you're going to go to a person who knows Krav Maga or other self-defense skills, will then think twice about the Jews are intrinsically a soft target. Just pursuant to that point, my own shul this coming Sunday in the evening is teaching the Nassau County coming and teach about how to deal with people if they get shot. You know what I mean? So there is a growing awareness that we're sort of waiting for a shoe to drop, and therefore getting Jews to defend themselves, and also maybe getting proper or some people getting proper armed training as well. In addition, in other words. But my point being is, I want to make a clear point here, is that clearly from the Parsha, from Moshe Rabbeinu, when Jewish lives are at stake, you can't, you know, I don't think as, you know, the question is it fair that we can just pay and outsource our security to others? Clearly, we see in the land of Israel, they're not doing that. And unfortunately, I want to say, you know, the Haredi community has many good qualities, but they do not take this thing very seriously yet. I think they're going to start changing. And I think those people remember in Israel where a guy came with an axe into the shul in Har Nof and basically butchered 4 people during davening. I mean, if there was and the thought always goes, if there was a guy in there with a gun, you know what I mean, you could take the guy down. Or a guy who was trained in Krav Maga and other skills to be able to deal with a a deadly situation. So it may not be for everybody, but I think it's worthwhile. Shane, if you could send the email out to the people on the call.
I don't know if I have everyone's email address.
Okay, so...
you're welcome to forward it.
Okay, so I'll forward it. Okay, I'll forward it to the people I saw on the call today. Okay, so I think if you have time, if you could jump on the call on this Friday to learn about the presentation, get more interested. But I think it's something that, you know, the Jewish community, our situation is not like it was a month ago. I think the things have changed dramatically. And we're not a warmongering people, but we're not pacifists either. And if, you know, and if people come to harm you, you got to be prepared. At least enough of the community has to be prepared. You got to take that as a community responsibility. So, Shada, thanks for sharing that with everybody. I'll pass that on to everybody. And maybe we can get a little spark of that Moshe-esque attitude. Basically, you know, you don't mess with Moshe.
Rabbi, I have... Yeah. A halachic question.
Yeah.
Are you permitted to violate the Sabbath by, carrying a concealed weapon? Is that permissible?
Well, as you all went to Israel, we saw dozens and dozens of policemen, many with kippot, and our army members of the IDF with kippot holding their guns, because it's a sakana, it's a danger for the Jewish people in Israel to not be armed. Now, in against the situation, in our own situation, again, I want to say the first thing is that it's not everybody should go get a gun, because first of all, our goal here is not to become crazy Rambo people. That's not the answer. To take the situation in a responsible way. So first is to learn self-defense is great. Two is, and then even if a person is going to be a person who has a gun, I'm going to assume if the person has gone through the 50 or 100 hours of training, okay? If we're talking about that kind of person, then, and if it's a risk, then no, it's not muksa, and it's not a problem. If there's a legitimate concern, just like there is in Israel, you see Orthodox Jews carrying weapons throughout Yerushalayim. We see it all the time. So that's but again, it has to be that you're part of the solution, not part of the problem, because we don't want to get people getting crazy and, like, you know, get having the Rambo emotion that they're going to be taking people down. You know what I'm saying? But if assuming that it's done in concert with the shul, in other words, the shul will have, let's say, a person who's involved with security in the shul, and they have it in concert, say, look, I'm trained. Let's say I was part of the IDF. I was in a late platoon. I have weapons training. I am allowed in the state of New York to have a concealed weapon. I want to ensure that when we go to shul, not only do we have somebody on the outside with a weapon, but somebody who knows what they're doing on the inside. To me, that's a no-brainer. But again, you see all those factors? It's not a guy go down to Dick's and buy himself the gun. That's not what I'm talking about here. Okay, we're talking about a person who has the gun and has the training and is working in concert with the shul, then I think in this day and age, to have that, it's not a problem. In New York. Because the truth is, we're just waiting for another attack.
God forbid something happens, but I just want to mention, just so it's in people's minds, if they are at MJE and something does happen, I think that, you know, what you should, the first response should be to try to be behind the Aron Kodesh, behind the Torah scrolls furniture. There's an exit. And, you know, my first response would be to try to reach that exit.
Right. So there's a whole approach of fleeing. I'm not here. I don't want to step into the role of I'm not a security expert, and I don't want to even, you know, what to do. There's a protocol in the Jewish Center already. I don't want to go into that right now. I'm going to stop the recording.